The number of the day today, 500 million. Yahoo! Or not really. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday today, the 22nd of September. Good as always to have you along, everybody. You know another way to say 500 million? Half a billion. That's how. That's at least how many user accounts Yahoo said today were hacked in an incident 2 years ago that Yahoo attributes to, and this is their quote, a state-sponsored actor. The revelation could almost literally not come at a worse time for the company and for its CEO, Marissa Mayer. They are about this close to wrapping up a deal to sell Yahoo's core assets to Verizon. We got our senior tech correspondent, Molly Wood, on the line to make me smart. Hey, Molly.
Hey, Kai.
All right, a couple of things to tick through here. First of all, those 500 million users, what does this mean for them?
Yeah, those 500 million users, as I said on Twitter, need to grab a bottle and settle in for a long night of Netflix and changing passwords.
Yeah, because they got everything, right?
They got everything. And so if you have ever reused, and I'm pretty sure this applies to 90% of the 500 million. Yeah. If you've ever reused any of those passwords, it's not enough to change those Yahoo passwords. You have to change the passwords on any site you've ever reused those passwords on. That's probably the single most important thing that anybody who uses Yahoo can do right now.
Right, because they will take those passwords and then try other sites that you have a login on, right?
Exactly. Right. And that's a pretty significant number. You know, that's what hackers do. They make attempts at other websites. And if they can get into your email, then they can get into your bank account. And it just kind of cascades from there.
Right. Second, probably to the users in being worried about this is Verizon, who's about to spend $5 billion to buy in part this massive Yahoo user base.
Yeah. Verizon's statement upon finding out about this hack 2 days ago. And we know that the investigation into this breach has been going on for about 2 years. That statement sounded a little cranky, if you read between the lines. A little cranky. Because, you know, it has been an ongoing issue. There's suspicion that this could be even a separate hack from one that Yahoo revealed this summer that affected about 200 million users. Yeah. If they have two breaches of that size going on and their prospective buyers didn't know about it, that deal could be in trouble. Certainly, if it goes through, I would not expect Marissa Mayer to remain in her job.
Yeah, well, we'll get to Mayer in just a second. But I do want to ask about the timing on this thing, because the statement from Yahoo said a recent investigation uncovered a possible hack in 2014. Are you kidding me? 2014?
Yep. I mean, these are the questions that are going to be unfolding as this story continues to develop, for lack of a more cliche way to put that. But that is the question. And, you know, this is common, unfortunately, with big data breaches and hacks like this, that companies take a really long time, probably to get their legal ducks in order, before they let users know about these security breaches. But there's going to be a lot of digging into that question and why Yahoo didn't ask users to change their passwords in August when they were talking about a breach.
Right. Okay, Marissa Mayer, one cannot imagine that she is long for this company.
It wasn't likely that she was going to remain too long after this merger. This is almost certainly the death blow, because you have to assume there's some significant mismanagement going on if a hack of this size happened under her watch, for one thing, and second, was not disclosed for 2 years.
Right. Molly Wood, our senior tech correspondent. Thank you, Molly.
My pleasure, Kai.
Yahoo shares, interestingly enough, up a penny on the day. The major indices up as well. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Charlotte, North Carolina is recovering from a second night of protests over the police shooting of a 43-year-old African-American man named Keith Scott on Tuesday. Tear gas was used last night. Businesses were damaged. The National Guard will be there tonight. And now city leaders have another worry, a call by some today for an economic boycott of Charlotte. So what does that city's economy look like anyway? Marketplace's Rima Kreis has that one.
During last night's protests, the Aria Tuscan Grill evacuated all 40 of its guests.
Because our ventilation started pumping the tear gas into the restaurant.
Andrew Shook is the assistant manager. Today, the place is open, but its next-door neighbors like Wells Fargo and Bank of America told their employees to stay home. Charlotte is the second-largest banking center after New York City, says Tom Hanchett, a local historian.
From the very beginning, Charlotte's been a trading city. The Nation's Path, which was a major Native American trade route, ran through here.
He says the city is also home to some big businesses, Duke Energy, Bojangles, Family Dollar. From afar, the city is an economic powerhouse, says Amy Hahn Nelson, a researcher with UNC Charlotte Urban Institute. But look at a map of Charlotte and you'll see a very large pie wedge that is
predominantly white and affluent with very high incomes. And then some would describe what you see as the rest of the demographics as a crescent of poverty.
Too many people in my city are living hard.
Joel Ford is a Democratic senator from Charlotte. He says African Americans have an unemployment rate that's double that for white people. Also, almost 80% of the city's homeless are black.
It's harder to climb out of poverty here than in any other U.S. metro area. The odds of moving up in Charlotte are just 4.4%.
35-year-old Justin Perry says that's one of the reasons why he joined last night's protests.
It was not simply just about, you know, Keith Lamont Scott. This was about a lot of other stories that we don't even know.
Stories, he says, of economic frustration, feeling beaten down in a city that's thriving. I'm Rima Crace for Marketplace.
If you had almost literally more money than you knew what to do with, what might you do? Most of us won't ever have to answer that question. Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg and his wife, Dr. Priscilla Chan, do, and they have decided how to spend at least part of it. The couple, under the auspices of something called the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative, are going to invest $3 billion over the next decade to cure disease, like all disease. The initiative is set up as what's known as a limited liability company, not a foundation, a tad unusual, perhaps, for a charitable group. Gigi Duan explains why it might be better here.
Basic science research is kind of a grind. You make tiny advances over a long period of time. Breakthroughs can take decades if they ever come. And finding the money to back that kind of work? Easy, right?
No, it's extremely difficult to come by.
Bob Tejan would know. He's a biochemist at UC Berkeley and has advised Priscilla Chan and Mark Zuckerberg on their charitable venture. He says most big public funding agencies don't like risk. And the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative is more outside the box.
Which means that you're going to have a higher failure rate, but you also have a much higher probability of making some really transformative discoveries.
What's interesting is that this philanthropic organization is set up not as a nonprofit, not as a private foundation, but as an LLC. Jacob Harold, CEO at GuideStar, says this isn't the first time he's seen this, especially out of Silicon Valley.
In financial terms, they're buying optionality.
That means they're going to pour billions of dollars in the social good, but they're not yet deciding what form that'll take.
That's what this is fundamentally about. It's about flexibility.
Flexibility to spend their money on a great company that needs capital, or even lobbying or political donations, which isn't allowed under other charitable setups. They do give up a charitable tax deduction with an LLC. But as Jill Manny, executive director at NYU's National Center on Philanthropy and the Law, points out, when you're as rich as the Zuckerberg Chans, that deduction wouldn't really pay off.
Roughly, it's about 30% of adjusted gross income, and that's a very small number compared to the billions of dollars they're going to give away.
And she says under their circumstances, it's just not that big a deal. I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
What's worse than having to issue a product recall for your ice cream? Having to issue a product recall for your ice cream twice. Bluebell ice cream is being recalled because of listeria concerns again. This one is a little different than the recall a year ago. The company's only recalling ice cream produced in a plant in Alabama because it was made with a chocolate chip cookie dough supplied by a third party. So not all that bad for Bluebell, but bad enough. Marketplace's Andy Euler has the story.
Listeria is basically ubiquitous, but when it gets into food like cheese or ice cream, it can make you really sick, can even kill. Food safety expert Barry Parsons says we're getting better at finding it, but it's probably always going to be there.
Can it be prevented? Yes. Can it be 100% eliminated? I don't think so. But ultimately, the company is responsible to ensure that, you know, once it hits the public, once it gets into the stream of commerce, that it is free and clear of any listeria.
And that's why Bluebell is erring on the safe side. The company took a major hit last year when it had to recall all of its ice cream because listeria was found in its factory. It changed its testing protocol and had to go on a public relations spending spree. Bill Marler is a food safety lawyer in Seattle.
Just the cost of the whole process of recalling it and having customers upset and restaurants upset and recalling all that product is very expensive.
But he says that cost is better than the alternative, going out of business, which can happen if people don't trust your food. For Bluebell, this recall isn't because anyone got sick. It's more of a precaution because listeria was found at the plant where the cookie dough used in its ice cream is made. Jay Neal is a food microbiologist at the University of Houston. He says Bluebell's product loyalty is unlike any he's ever seen, and he thinks they're going to be just fine.
I think really the consumer's response is going to be, I can't get cookie dough? Okay, I'm going to get 2 gallons of the ones I can get, just in case. It wouldn't surprise me if actually sales went up.
People in Texas say it's the best ice cream in the country. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
There's a report out today from the Bipartisan Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget laying out how much each presidential candidate's various policies would add to the national debt. Works out to about $200 billion for Hillary Clinton, $5.3 trillion for Donald Trump in extra debt, which reminded us that there's a story we've been meaning to do about Mr. Trump's maternity leave announcement last week. How, even without actual cost specifics from the campaign on this, but how is it going to be paid for? From our desk at Oregon Public Broadcasting, Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman looked into it.
Donald Trump says his new paid maternity leave would be completely paid for through savings within the existing unemployment insurance system by cracking down on fraud and improper payments. How much could that squeeze out?
So this is something we actually know a lot about.
Andrew Stettner at the Progressive Century Foundation says the Labor Department rigorously audits state unemployment funds.
About 10% of all payments are classified as an overpayment. So that's about $3.4 billion.
And what are overpayments? Mostly accidental paperwork and math mistakes, people getting higher benefits than they're entitled to. Stettner says the government claws back a lot of that from recipients at tax time. That leaves about $1 billion actually lost to intentional benefit fraud. Economist Apurna Mathur at the conservative-leaning American Enterprise Institute says trying to recoup every last wasted or stolen dollar just isn't worth it.
At the end of the day, there is a cost to enforcing and getting those dollars back. And it's hard to imagine that this is a sustainable source of new funds every year.
And keep in mind, the system isn't in great financial shape to begin with. Many states kept their unemployment taxes low to help employers and then couldn't afford to pay benefits when the recession hit. At the end of last year, only 18 states had enough put away to cover the next recession, let alone any new maternity leave claims that might arrive on their doorsteps. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Coming up.
To do this privately was a seemingly crazy idea.
Good thing there are crazy rich people then, huh? But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials gained 98 points today, 0.5%, 18,392. The NASDAQ rose 44 points, rather, 0.8%, 5,339. The S&P 500 up 14 points, 0.6%, 2,177. If you're in real estate, low interest rates are a great thing. That showed today after yesterday's Fed decision to not decide on rates. The S&P's real estate sector just created, by the way, up nearly 2% today. Yahoo, we told you about, basically flat. Shares of Verizon, which, as of right now, is buying Yahoo, up 0.9%. Meanwhile, headphone jacks be damned. Sales of Apple's iPhone 7 are higher than expected, according to an analyst report. Time to bring out the happy emojis. Apple up 0.9%. Bond prices up, the yield on the 10-year T-note, thus down 1.61%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. There's going to be a ceremony in Cartagena, Colombia on Monday in which the peace deal between the Colombian government and the guerrilla group known as the FARC, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, is going to be signed. There's still going to have to be a public referendum to approve the thing, and the deal is not universally popular. But if it sticks, it could put billions of dollars into the Colombian economy in the form of government spending and foreign investment. Among the interested foreign governments is this one, the United States. But in Colombia, exactly how a peace deal might work is far from settled. From Bogota, Lauren Madelon reports.
That simple echo of a handheld bell summons lawmakers into the Colombian Senate. They vote to let citizens themselves say yes or no to peace with the FARC. Dario Hidalgo's here, not a politician, just an engaged citizen.
Suddenly you hear that some soldiers are killed, some policemen are killed. And this is everyday news, or was.
Hidalgo researches the economics of mass transit and urban planning. A peace deal would mean the government has more money to spend on things like infrastructure. But for him, this vote isn't just about the economy. Hidalgo says his cousin was killed by the FARC. Still, he'll be voting yes.
We won't have immediate peace and there will be criminals. There are still narcotics. But knowing that there's no guerrillas is a really big improvement.
Colombia and the U.S. have a lot at stake. They have a free trade agreement. U.S. behemoths like ExxonMobil and Coca-Cola are players here. In 2015, Colombia was the 20th largest market for U.S. exporters. Agricultural equipment, auto parts. Well, peace in theory should expand that.
But it's totally dependent on political stability and lack of violence in Colombia, and that remains to be seen.
Former U.S. Assistant Defense Secretary Michael Nacht is now at the Goldman School of Public Policy at the University of California at Berkeley. If Colombia is stable for the next, say, 3 to 6 months, well, Nacht says its battered economy should improve as Colombia diverts money from the war to development.
Then you'll see the business community start to really re-engage with Colombia.
It's unclear right now if hope for a better economy will prevail over widespread disdain for the FARC.
Nobody in Colombia knows how it is to live and do politics without the FARC in the picture.
That's Colombian Senator Claudia Lopez.
This society, for good reasons, hate the FARC.
But she'll vote yes. She says Colombia can't attract serious investment without peace. She says the economy has historically been crippled by violence perpetrated by a host of leftist groups and on the other side of the political spectrum, right-wing elements within the state.
If we do a peace process, you're not going to be able to use violence, right? Neither the FARC, but nor the state.
But things aren't so simple. Álvaro Uribe, Colombia's former president and now a senator, is leading the no campaign against this deal.
If those responsible for atrocities do not go to jail, this process will be a midwife of new violence.
Again, Senator Claudia Lopez.
So we need to imagine how is it like to take the risk to stop that conflict and to tackle the challenges and the conflicts that's still going to remain.
And Dario Hidalgo, whose family still mourns the loss of his cousin to the violence, agrees.
And that's what is so important, that this peace agreement is signed. Even if we have to accept hard things to swallow.
When Colombians vote in the referendum, they'll need to decide that essential question, whether Colombia should forego justice for many guilty parties to forge peace and with it, hopes for a more stable economy. In Bogota, I'm Lorne Madelon for Marketplace.
There was a time, not really all that long ago, when space travel, the whole building a spaceship and putting people in it thing, took basically a whole country to do, a big country at that. Today, as we know, there is a whole new private space race going on, a race that traces back to 1996 in something called the X Prize, and a guy by the name of Peter Diamandis, the story of which is told in Julian Guthrie's new book. It's called How to Make a Spaceship. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Probably ought to start with Peter Diamandis, who he was and why he was obsessed, I guess is the word, with space.
He really was obsessed. He's the biggest space geek, and I say that as a compliment, who I've ever met. So he was 8 years old when Apollo 11 landed in July 1969, and he was transfixed, I think like so many people were. He went out from there on this kind of adventure story, and originally with the mission of getting to space through NASA.
Well, so let's actually take that as a jumping off point, because go back 20 years, plus or minus, and remind me how crazy it was back then to suggest that private industry, private people, were going to be leading this country into space in the next generation and not the government.
Well, it was completely crazy. It was a crazy notion. And Peter, you know, realized that NASA was either winding down manned space missions. You know, the Apollo missions were canceled, and then there were these tragedies that involved the space shuttle. Mm. So private space just did not exist. The three largest governments, United States, the then Soviet Union, and China, were the only ones who were able to send man and machine to space and return him safely back to Earth. Mm-hmm. So thinking about this, you know, to do this privately was a seemingly crazy idea.
So he comes up with this idea then of the X Prize with a very specific set of circumstances. What were they?
It's interesting because he got this idea for a modern-day space prize, kind of a private race to space, by reading Lindbergh's The Spirit of St. Louis, reading that a fellow named Raymond Orteig had offered a $25,000 prize to aviators who could fly from New York to Paris or Paris to New York. And Peter had this aha moment, and he thought, you know, what if I could do for private space what Orteig, through Lindbergh and through this prize, did for commercial aviation? He launched the X Prize, announced it in 1996, $10 million prize for the first private non-governmental team that can get to 100 kilometers, 62 miles.
Well, take me now out to the Mojave Desert then, and talk to me about scaled composites and Burt Rutan and how this all comes together to make that very first flight.
Oh, my God. This is, you know, one of the great moments in entrepreneurial adventure stories. I mean, I love Burt Rutan. He is, I don't use the word genius lightly, but he really is. So there's a race to the end. There are other teams who are in the hunt trying to win this prize as well. So come, you know, 2003, Burt Rutan has rolled out this private spaceship program, and he launches his first attempt at suborbital flight in June 2004 and made history in that moment. That was a precursor to two XPRIZE flights. The XPRIZE required promote reusability in rockets, that you had to fly twice within 2 weeks to the so-called start of space.
What's the difference between what Burt Rutan and Scaled Composites did with the Spaceship One flights as part of the XPRIZE, and what Jeff Bezos is doing now with his company and what Elon Musk is doing with SpaceX?
Really, what Burt did was suborbital flight. And what Elon Musk is doing is orbital, which is, you know, a magnitude of difference. What Jeff Bezos is doing is kind of a stepping stone approach. Mm-hmm. He started with suborbital, and now his pursuit is also orbital. And Elon and Jeff Bezos are both looking to get passengers to space within by the time the decade is out.
Would you take a ride?
Oh, absolutely. I don't know if I want to be the first on it.
Fair enough. It's called How to Make a Spaceship by Julian Guthrie. Julian, thanks very much.
Thank you for having me.
We've got an excerpt of her book on our website, of course, marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, getting back sort of to where we started with that big Yahoo hack. You know who's not going to have to worry too much about getting hacked? North Korea. That's who. Not only is there that whole totalitarian state thing, yes, but earlier this week, somebody in Pyongyang basically clicked on the wrong button or something, and that let the people in the tech world who follow these things see that there are only 28 websites, top-level domains technically, but basically 28 websites in that whole country. 28. Okay, we got to go. The Dow up 98 points today, about a half percent, 18,392. The NASDAQ up 44 points, 0.8%, 5,339 there. The S&P 500 up 14 points, about 0.6%, 21.77. John Buckley, Deirdre Debke, Eve Epstein, George Judson, Suzanne Levy, Andrea Seabrook, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizzo. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.